Well, good morning, and welcome to worship here at Outreach Red Bank. This morning, I want to share with you a story about the idolatry of a nation and the courage of three young men who decided not to conform, but instead stood up for what was right, regardless of the consequences. I want you to look at these words. The beginning and cause and end of every evil is for the worship of idols to go unnamed. That is a strong statement. Several decades before Jesus was born, in the city of Alexandria, an Egyptian city, the Roman soldiers flooded in and took that place away from the people who lived there. There was a strong community of Jewish folks there who lived in that place, and they were unprepared for the disastrous disappointment of this foreign invasion. All of their freedom, their sense of liberty, and their identity as a people, religiously speaking, was torn right from their hands as this foreign occupying power, unwelcomed, came in and took everything from them. I imagine their disappointment was along the same order of magnitude as when their people centuries before had been taken off into exile in Babylon. Now, any man who loves life and has the fire of faith in his heart does not just sit back and let the foreign power roll over him in a moment like this, but he stands to fight. Of course, the truth was at this time, any fight with the fist or the sword against Rome would be literally a dead end. No community would stand any chance against that power. And so one man, at this point in time, took up the fight with a pen, and he wrote these words: "The beginning and cause and end of every evil is for the worship of idols to go unnamed." Looking around him in that time, seeing all of the wickedness and the cruelty, not just the wickedness of the foreign power of Rome coming in and hurting his people, but the wickedness and the cruelty of the Jews who compromised themselves, sold out to this foreign power, totally let go of their identity. Seeing all of that, he asked why. And the answer was, in his mind, idolatry. When a man decides to turn all of his hopes and aspirations and trusts over to anything that's not the true God, the end is the kind of disillusionment that turns him inevitably into a monster. When a woman sets her hope on anything other than God himself, the creator of the heavens and earth, and puts all of her desire and her will and her decisions in the hands of anything other than that God, no matter how she begins, no matter how good it seems, she will inevitably end up becoming a tyrant who destroys herself and everyone who crosses her path. If this man were right, it means that the person who exchanges the throne of the true God on her heart or on his heart and places anything else there will end up becoming the instrument of the wickedness that destroys humanity. And if this is right, then it would stand to reason that the opposite would also be true. That is, when a man or a woman decides to turn his attention, his hope, all of his trust over to the true God, then in so doing, he becomes the instrument for the greatest potential good. That when God is rightly sitting on the heart of any man or woman, they become thereby the tool that God might use to bring light into the darkness, to bring good into the wickedness, to overcome all the trouble that harasses humanity. Does it seem like this could have been written today? Of course, idolatry is a problem that's easy to see in ancient cultures. And maybe we're happy that we've grown away from such rituals and the kind of foolish devotion to things that used to plague people. Now we're so enlightened. I hope that today we get to see a little bit of how we ourselves are threatened, just as cultures in the past were, with replacing the true God with a false God. And not just to see that for the sake of curiosity or intellectual satisfaction, but so that you as an individual and us as a collective might become people who learn to dethrone the false gods from our hearts and thereby become people who participate in God's work in the world to bring about the restitution of this culture and this world that is so degraded. Our focus will be on a story that was written many centuries before these words. In the book of Daniel, there are these fantastic stories of a culture that's totally enveloped in idolatry on the one hand, and then, on the other hand, these stellar figures, these young men. There's four of them who we meet in the beginning of the book. Daniel is the name of one for whom the book is named. But then there are these three others who are central to the story I want us to look at together. Their names are called Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're young men. But in the midst of a culture that is entirely swallowed up in worshiping false gods, these three young men stand as an example that for us might be a true set of what it would look like to be true people who set God on our hearts and not everything else that might sit there. And so together we're going to look at a story, the story of these three men, and it appears in Daniel chapter 3. Before I read the story, I want to set the stage for you so we're ready to see what we'll see. The book begins, the book of Daniel, begins by expressing the environment of exile. The Babylonian Empire, which was the neighbor for Israel to the north and east, had come into the land and overrun with their might and their strength the people of Israel. They decimated their homes. They destroyed their religious artifacts and their temple. They killed many of the leading people in that community, and the rest they brought with them off into exile. They brought them as refugees into the land where King Nebuchadnezzar was the ruler, the land of Babylon. In the beginning of that book, we read of a program of psychological reformation that's kind of eerie. It's haunting. There is a group that targets the young men of the noble families from Israel, and taking these young men and separating them from their families and placing them all together, we read about a regiment of changing their minds through the sort of subtle psychological methods that are used by tyrants everywhere and all throughout history. They begin by placing these young men in an educational program where for years they're taught to think like the people of that kingdom. They're learning the history of that place, the language of that place, the culture and the ideology is pressed into their young minds. Their diets are changed. They're given a regimen of food that's designed and especially specified for them from this kingdom. The ways they used to eat is removed, and now they're given new food. Their names are changed. And we know of these three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they used to have names that bore in the midst of them the name of the God of Israel, Yahweh. But now their names bear the gods of these people, the Babylonians, the names of the Baals. Their food is changed, their education is transformed, their names are changed. These three young men are forced into a program where their minds are reprogrammed. Now, along with this psychological reformation of the youngsters, the culture itself is entirely awash in idolatry. In the beginning of chapter 3, which is where we're going to look, we learn that the king, Nebuchadnezzar, has had a statue of himself crafted. It's a mighty, gigantic, impressive testimony to his power and strength. After all, he was the head of the conquering nation, and so this statue is set up in the head of a valley, and there in the plains around the statue, all of the people are gathered together to stand before the statue. Everyone, the kids, the adults, everyone who's in the whole entire country is brought together in front of this large statue, and there, in the midst of this great throng of people, there are the musicians who stand up front, and King Nebuchadnezzar's governors, who stand at the head of it all, and they make the following announcement. And this is in verse 4 of chapter 3. Here's the setting in which the story unfolds. The herald, and that is the one who announces what will happen from the king, stands up front, and he announces, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, drum, and entire musical ensemble, you are to fall down and worship the golden statue that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up." This is a vivid scene, and it sounds like what we think of when we think of the word idolatry, doesn't it? a large crowd of people all gathered together, and there in the front of all of these people is a gigantic physical object to which they're meant to direct their devotion and their attention. It's a gigantic statue. All of these people together are whipped up into some kind of emotional frenzy by carefully selected music. They have all of the instruments there. It's strange. We don't have anything like this at all in our own culture. This is just weird. All of the people stand together. The music starts. Trigon, what is that? Trigon? That's not an instrument. All of the people are together. When the music starts, everyone bows down. They kneel like this. It's something you see in a movie. All of them go down, and that is idol worship. Isn't that weird and strange and so far away from us? If idolatry is a simple matter of these kind of external behaviors, bowing down in front of a physical object, then you and I are totally safe. We've got nothing to do with idolatry, if that's what it looks like. Who among us has ever been at an event where you must bow down before a statue? No one. We're not going to be at an event like this. If idolatry is essentially an external act of bowing down before a statue, then we're safe. Then worshiping false gods is a problem that other people have that we can comfortably criticize from where we sit, isn't it? Listen, I'm going to sit for this. Worship and idolatry is not, first of all, an external act of bowing down before something. It is, first of all, an internal disposition. It is the attitude of the heart. It is the inclination of what is inside of you. It is the tendency in every one of us, which is built into us as human beings, to see that there is something ultimate in the world and it's not us. And idolatry is the moment when any man or woman looks to something other than the true God to be their source of hope, the thing in which they trust, the thing which they believe will liberate them and free them, the thing which will give them a future that is secure and strong, and the thing that they can set all of their desires and will and affection upon. That is what it means to set up an idol. Whenever there is anything other than the true God that takes the place of that central, ultimate thing, that is when a person is engaged in idolatry. It may lead to an external act of bowing down. It usually does not. It does lead to all kinds of other external acts. The best image that I know of for what idolatry really is comes from the poet David. We've already heard several psalms read this morning. He was an immensely perceptive man, close to God. He understood what it meant to be a human. He made mistakes. He struggled. He suffered. He rose up again as God lifted him. He was a true human being. He thought about idolatry a lot because he saw it all around him. He saw it in himself. And he one day asked the question, what is it? What is it about the man or the woman who's safe from setting up false gods? What is it about the person who sits in God's presence truly? The person who does not sink into the worship of idols so that they become an instrument of evil and wrecks and rules this world? What is it that keeps a person from idolatry? He asked that question. He answered it in Psalm 24 and 25. Here's how he put it. It's just such a magnificent phrase that I want you to see it and write it down if you're a note taker. Those who do not lift their soul to what is false. Worship, devotion, is first of all a matter of the thing to which you lift your soul. Now, you may be a person who's very conscious of the fact that you have a relationship with God, that you are a Christian pursuing the true Lord. You are lifting your soul. You may be a person who says, no, I'm not a religious person. I don't have a God. You still have something to which you lift your soul. The image is so brilliant. Imagine, if you would, the picture of a man kneeling down, and in his hands he has his soul. Now, we tend to think of soul in Greek terms. The Greeks had this conception of humanity that a person was partly spiritual and partly physical. The part that really mattered is the spiritual part, and that's the part we call the soul. The Hebrews did not think like that. For them, soul was the combination of the spiritual and the physical, without which it could never exist, that comprised things like the affections, the desires and the love that stirs inside of a person. It held on to things like their thoughts, the world of their ideas, the things that they longed for and were afraid of, the thought patterns that characterize their internal lives, their will, the things that help them make decisions. All of this for the Hebrew was wrapped up in the thing that was called the soul. Now again, picture a woman who is lifting this, her soul, the very essence of herself, everything that makes her the person she is, lifting that to something. It's an image of extreme vulnerability. This woman sets her very self in the hands of something other than her. It's an image of extreme trust, absolute trust. The man who does this, lifting his soul to something, he is saying in the process, I entrust all of myself into your hands. If you would picture the image of a planetary system, for instance, this is another way of thinking of it. You have at the center of a planetary system a great mass, and then around it you have in orbit these smaller bodies. And their trajectory, the places they can go, the way they move, their future is all determined by the thing around which they orbit. The man who lifts his soul to something says, in effect, my life is going to orbit around this thing in the center. It will determine my hopes. It will determine my dreams. I will look to it for my liberation and my freedom. When it comes to protection, that's where I'll look. When it comes to my aspirations for who I'll be and what I should do with my life, all of it will revolve around this thing to which I lift my soul. To worship is to lift your soul to something. You, every one of you, was made to be a person who lifts her soul, to lift his soul to something. Now come with me for a moment back to this story of these people who are standing before that statue and then bowing down before it. They're not lifting their soul to the statue. They're not. It looks like that to us. They are bowing down inside to the military power of King Nebuchadnezzar. Because as a people, they've learned to trust in his might. When they had problems as a culture, where did they look? They looked to the might of their armies. When they wanted a more secure future for their children and for themselves as a collective, they looked to the strength and the power of the horses and chariots of Nebuchadnezzar's mighty forces that marched right in to the enemy territory and overthrew those people, bringing their resources into their own culture for their own good. They were not bowing down to the statue. Inside, they were bowing down to the God of power. The God of force, the God of violence against anyone who turns their back on it, and who blesses everyone who gets in line. Their God was the military. And that's why everyone bowed down then. What are the gods that you and I are tempted to worship? What are the idols that have presented themselves in our own day as worthy of our souls? What are the things that stand before you as worthy objects of your hope, of your trust, of your affection, of all of your desires for yourself and for the future? It will not be a gigantic golden statue. But it will be, and it is for us, oh, there are so many of them. It will be some object that demands your ultimate allegiance. And here's a clue to finding out what it is for you. It will be something that you are sure you can't do without because you're afraid of what would happen if you didn't get it. Now, I think this is demonstrably true, and we'll talk about the kinds of gods that present themselves to us, but it's also in a subtle way in the story. I'm going to move us up a little bit, and feel free, by the way, and I would encourage you to do this, to read the whole chapter, chapter 3 of Daniel. It's just remarkable what happens in this story, but there's a clue that helps us discover what the false gods are for us in the way the story unfolds. Let me just describe it and then we'll read another bit. Everyone's together, the music starts, every single person bows down. I think we're meant to picture thousands of people all bowing down to the ground. But there are three who do not. And they are the characters that I mentioned at the start, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. When everyone else bows down, they don't. Have you ever been in an environment where everyone is doing something and you feel like you shouldn't? It's hard not to do it, isn't it? These three stand up. They won't bow down. Of course, this attracts the attention of the leaders of that area. They grab these three young men. They drag them before the king because they're not getting in line, and that's always a threat to a false god. And it always must be met with some kind of negative, it always must be met with some kind of negative consequences. And so it is in this story. And these three young men are threatened and made to fear the consequences of refusing to worship this false god in this particular way. Look at verse 15. Before the king, they are addressed as follows. Now, if you are ready when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, drum, and entire musical ensemble to fall down and worship the statue I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be thrown into a furnace of blazing fire. And who is the God that will deliver you out of my hands? King Nebuchadnezzar is very clear with these three young men. If they will not bow down and worship the statue, remember, if they will not lift their hearts, their souls, to military strength, the consequences will be that they will be physically destroyed. Do you see the connection between the false god and the threat of outcome? The false god is the one who promises to protect you from destruction. The threat, if you will not worship this god, is that you will be physically destroyed. It is always like this in relation to every false god. And I'll tell you where I've done my research. You ready for this? I was in the hospital for 8 hours straight about 2.5 weeks back with my son. In every room we sat in, guess what there was? A TV. It was always on. You weren't allowed to change the channel. You could not press mute when the commercials came on. I watched for 8 hours. And I'm telling you that I saw about three themes that ran through all of the commercials and the programs that the commercials were interrupting. And these themes all were connected to, on the one hand, a promise of something very good, a false god, and on the other hand, a threat if you did not bow down and worship that god. Okay? These three may be true for you. They may not be your gods. But here's what I saw in those 8 hours. There were three. Money, physical appearance, and the attention from your peers that comes from success. Those are the three themes. Let me be more specific. First, money. I observed, myself with my son Nathaniel there, countless commercials for products, programs, DVDs, consultants, or books that promised you in this coming year the financial security that you always deserved, that you need, that's just three simple steps away, and which will make your entire life perfect from now on. I could not believe it. It was stunning. The promises were so simple. All I need to do is invest $19.99. Look at that guy's teeth. He must be telling the truth. Every single, every one of these commercials was so easy. It was just do these things, buy this book, get my program, and you'll be on the path to financial freedom. It wasn't just the commercials that peddled this idea. Every news program filled me with fright. The economy is going sour. The real estate market is on the fall. The markets are diminishing. Oh, you must figure out how to get out of this dismay. Because if you don't, if you will not center your hopes around the financial freedom that you can get in this way, if you will not get your assets in order, if you will not secure for your children this particular college program, if you will not get this kind of retirement plan for yourself, doom and gloom. You will be ruined. You will be empty. You won't have anything that you need. You will be thrown into a fiery furnace if you will not bow down and worship this god of money. I'm telling you, it was uncanny. It was not just the commercials. It was the news reports. It was the comments that weathermen made. It was everywhere. Get money and you'll be okay. Fail to bow down and you will be destroyed. That was one theme. Another theme was physical beauty. You didn't need to hear the words to see the way the women who introduced this car or this wristwatch or whatever, what they looked like. They were so scantily clad. They were selling beers in the snow wearing bikinis. It was absurd. Then there were these products. This gym, membership is cheap. Enroll now, it's cheaper. There was this ridiculous thing that you shook and it changed your arms. There was this ab thing that you did over and over and then rah! There were these pills that you bought and they made you have biceps and triceps and quadriceps and all of these things, muscles on top of muscles. And at the end of every one of these was this image of the man who looks so good the women want him. or the woman who's got just the right waistline, whose body is proportioned just so, the bags are not there under her eyes anymore. She bought this thing she wipes underneath. Her double chin is now singular. All of these things. I mean, in a remarkable way and in an astoundingly offensive way that should deeply unsettle us. Again, it was all about money. This time, just taking your money out of your pockets and putting it in someone else's pockets. Again, the threat. If you don't bow down and worship this God of beauty, you will be reduced to a lonely soul who's not shaped right and therefore doesn't fit in and is not the object of anyone's desire. You should be ashamed of yourself if you don't look like this. Bow down and worship this God, or you'll be thrown into the furnace of fire. The third one, this theme, which was harder to pinpoint because it was less sold in commercials but more in programs, was this theme of the God of being accepted yourself by your peers for success. It sort of ran throughout everything, but it's especially obvious in these so-called reality TV shows where this group is brought together and their peers decide whether or not to vote them off. And everybody in the nation watches. Oh, we can't wait to see that loser rejected so that we can feel a bit better about ourselves and imagine in that other person who's pushed aside, someone who's not us. And so we can identify psychologically with the victor, the one who humiliates and shames the other people around them and is thereby exalted, whether it's on an idol show, I mean, idol, American Idol, it's even called that, a show where you sing better or perform better than the other people, and so you're not humiliated like everybody else. Or it's on some show where you're at the Jersey Shore or somewhere else in between. This narrative is presented to you and to me and to our children and to everyone in this country that if you would only fit in, if you would only achieve the acceptance of the people around you, then your soul will be satisfied. Lift your soul to the God of personality, the God of being accepted, of fitting in. And then everything will be fine. You choose not to worship this God, and then you will be destroyed. You will be chewed up and thrown away. You'll be tossed into a furnace of fire. I will tell you that our culture is supremely idolatrous. We live in an incredibly religious place. The polytheism of our time is enormous. The things aren't often called gods, but that's exactly what they are. They are the things to which we have been challenged to lift our souls in trust, in hope, and the threat of what happens if we won't is as real as it was for these young men. We'll be thrown into a furnace of fire if we will not. Listen to those words that we began with again. The cause, the beginning, and the end of every kind of evil is when the worship of idols goes unnamed. There is a tremendously sophisticated and well-funded machine in our culture that's designed to keep you from believing what I'm saying. Because if you start to believe it, you stop spending your money on things you don't need. You become a strong person. You become someone who's not so vulnerable to the wiles of the advertising industry, who is right now, as I speak, organizing their efforts to take your money at the expense of your heart. And what that does is it keeps our world and our country and us in this room in a place where we become the instruments of darkness to our own destruction. The call to worship the true God is not a call to give up good things. It's a call to be liberated from those lies, from all of the fear and insecurity that comes with believing them, and then to the freedom of becoming a true person on whose heart sits the true God, who is truly trustworthy, who is good, who is entirely faithful, who loves you more than you could ever ask or imagine, who has for you the true and good future of a liberation that has nothing to do with money, has nothing to do with your physical appearance, your sexual attractiveness. It has nothing to do with the praise of this culture, but has to do with his good and faithful pleasure in you as you become a real person. Like these three young men were real people. And because they were real, and because on their hearts sat the true God, they were able to stand in the midst of that culture, and they were able to stand when everyone else bowed. That's what this community is meant for, I believe. to be a community that does not bow down to all of the lies of this culture, but instead stands up, not for its own sake, not so you become some show-off among others, not so that people look at us and say how wonderful and grand they are, but simply for this reason, so that people see that all of those things that I watched on TV are a lie. And then, because of your faithfulness, not to yourself but to God, they are liberated from those lies. That's what we're meant to be as a culture, as a community here. We're meant to be a beacon of light, not for ourselves, but of the truth that would free this culture from these lies that are absolutely devastating it. And they are. They're totally destroying it. I want to show you at last what happens after these three young men refuse to bow down, after they're brought into the presence of this king, and they face the threat of what will happen if they will not worship the true, the false God. This is quite remarkable. It's one of my favorite moments in all of Scripture. This is why I chose to do this sermon this morning. Verse 16 reads as follows. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answer the king. Now remember, these are three young men, no power in themselves, standing before the mightiest force of their day. I love it. O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no reason to prevent a defense to you in this matter. Quickly, they know that they don't need to make an argument before this king. They know that fancy words or a convincing and compelling set of propositions does nothing to stand up against the idols of our day. That means the call for you or for me, if we will be a beacon of light in this place, is not that we learn how to argue with others. That doesn't do anything. And they knew it, and so they said it. We don't need to argue with you, king. If our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and out of your hand, O king, let him deliver us. They're saying to him, we're not going to fight with you. You've challenged us and said to us that if we are thrown into the fire, who's the God that will deliver us? Well, our God whom we worship, if he's able to deliver us, so be it. What they go on to say next is, in my mind, one of the boldest and bravest and most courageous and most character-filled statements there is. They do not say to the king, our God is definitely going to save us, and that's why we're not going to bow down. If we follow our God, he'll protect us from everything, and therefore, well, we're not going to be afraid of the consequences because he's going to save us. That wouldn't be very courageous, would it? Do you know what I mean by that? If they knew for sure that they were going to be delivered and said, well, we're not going to bow down, it really wouldn't be that much of an act of courage because, well, they knew, right? It's like the little kid who faces the bully in the schoolyard and says, I'm not going to back down. And the reason he says it is his big brother's behind the bushes with a bat. And he knows it. That's not courageous. Look at what they say in verse 18. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods and we will not worship the golden statue that you have set up. That means that they are aware of the fact that maybe God will choose not to deliver them. That they believe it's possible that this king will make them face the consequences he's pronounced, throwing them into the furnace, and perhaps that's the end of their lives. They know that's a possibility. And still, they say, we are not going to bow down to the false God. Because they know that it would be better to die worshiping the true God than to live lifting their soul to what is false. That is remarkable. Let me tell you this. If you believe what I've said about the false gods of money, the false gods of attractiveness, and fitting in with your peers, and you decide no longer to lift your soul to those things, your life might become harder financially. I mean that. You might find that the popularity that would have been yours if you did all of that investing with your funds into your appearance, you might not get some of the attention you would have otherwise received. The challenge for you and for me and for all of us is, will we, like these three young men, refuse to lift our souls to what is false, regardless of the threat? That's what they did, and I believe that's what our calling is. By the way, I am certain of this, that any gain that comes from lifting one's soul to that which is false is actually not a gain. In truth, it's only a liability. Everything you get for turning away from God in the end turns out to be ruinous. Every trifling trinket that is yours because you turned away from the true God and pursued a false one may satisfy you for a moment, but it will be fleeting. In the end, you will be empty and alone in a land of shadows all by yourself with no light at all. No matter what, a man can acquire the whole world in his hands, but if he does not have the true God, he has nothing. These three young men refused to bow down. Now, some of you know the end of the story. I would like it very much if you would read it, but let me just describe what happens in the end. It's quite striking. Nebuchadnezzar hears their refusal to bow down. He is so furious, he orders the furnace to be heated up 7 times as high as it usually is. He orders the very strongest guards he has to take and bind these three men in heavy cords. They are taken to the furnace. As the guards approach the fire to throw these young men in, they throw them in. It's so hot that the guards themselves are incinerated. They're burned up instantly. They die as they throw these men into the furnace. And then, as Nebuchadnezzar watches with all of his power and might, he observes that there in the flames are not three men who are immediately incinerated and turned into dust, but rather there are four. There's the presence of a fourth that was unanticipated who is there in the flames with them, and not one of them is hurt. Instead of writhing in agony, do you know what they do in the flames? They dance. Listen, bring it on. Bring on all the threats that the culture can marshal against us for failing to bow down to false gods. And if we are true and keep God on the center of our throne, the throne of our hearts, he will be with us whatever the flames come. And you know what we'll do? We'll dance. And this is the most, in my mind, the most brilliant part of the story. After they're done and they're removed from the flames that don't hurt them, and after the king sees what happens to them, he does not bow down and worship them. He does not praise them and laud them for something great that they've done. Instead, he asks them this question: what is the name of your God? Who is he? So that I and the others in my kingdom may worship the true God. And I want you to understand this, and this is how I'll close, that if you or I are able to stand up against the false gods in our culture, not only will we be freed from the tyranny of all of their false threats, but we will become God's instruments that make other people ask, who is the true God that you worship? I want to know him. And that is what our church is meant to be, a witness to the true God in a place where many don't know him. We need simple courage like these three young men. We keep the true God on our hearts, and that is what he will make of us. And let's pray now that he would do that. My God, I thank you for this beautiful story, which in some ways is old, but which in others is perfectly new. We may not bow down to giant golden statues, but we know that there are many, many false gods in our day that are presented to us as worthy objects of our devotion and our ultimate trust and hope and desire. Money, family, achievements, career, spiritual achievements, everything that exists can serve as a false god. We pray simply for your protection and for eyes to see when we are tempted to worship something false. And then, like these three young men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we ask that you would give us the courage and the character to stand and refuse to fall in line with all of the false gods, no matter what the outcome is. And then I pray that we would be, as you did with these three young men, protected and made into a beacon of your truth and your light, so that the world would come to know you through your protection, your help, your love, your guidance, and your strengthening of us. We pray in Jesus' name, the true God. Amen.